Good morning. You're listening to KUNV 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Koolikin. You can read my columns in the Las Vegas Sun at lasvegassun.com. As always, my co-host is Tovin Lepan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. A quick programming note. This is a momentous day in the annals of radio history. This is my final show Neon Eden. After literally dozens of shows that I think we'd all agree have rocked the radio world, it's all coming to an end. But fear not, Neon Eden lives on, and with a great replacement, that is Sun political reporter Andrew Doman, who joins us today. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And don't say thanks for having me. Just say, like, thanks for giving me the show.
Like, my show now. Get out.
We are also joined by his boss, Sun political editor, Anjanette Damon, up from Reno. Are you enjoying a lovely summer, Anjanette, in Reno?
Reno is fantastic every season, but I have to say, and I know I won't get much sympathy from you guys, but it's supposed to be 105 here this weekend. So,
boo-hoo.
About that.
Anjanette, we haven't spoken in a while, and there's been some movement on the 2014 election. What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, political reporters are kind of looking at the election as maybe going to be a little bit of a boring one compared to those that we've had the last maybe three or four election cycles, where we've had drag them out U.S. Senate races and presidential races, and now we're
cocktail waitresses and garages and
lots of drama. And I'm sure, being Nevada, that we will not be disappointed once we get into the thick of things. But right now, we're looking at the top of the ticket with the governor's race, and Governor Brian Sandoval is very popular so far, has not drawn a formidable Democratic challenger, and most likely won't. At this point, it's looking like. So that means that.
Well, it's
probably
a Senate.
The most interesting.
It does appear that County Commissioner Steve Sisolak will get in as a Democrat.
Yeah, I think Democrats are looking at him as their best hope at this point, and I don't know that he's made the decision yet. Last I heard, he's still kind of 50-50. They're doing some research to see if he has an actual pathway to victory. I don't think you'll see him get in if it looks like he does not have that path to victory. He's been very clear that he doesn't want to be a sacrificial lamb out there just beating up Sandoval for the Democrats. So if, you know, he does his groundwork and sees that he could be successful or at least make it a race, then we could be saved and not have a boring gubernatorial race.
Well, no, it's going to be really boring if he runs, because he's no different than Brian Sandoval. But what I think it's actually more interesting if he doesn't run, because then who do the Democrats go to? And I think you know who I think they should run.
Yeah, Tick Sucker Bloom. I think you've said that before. You know, and Sisolak, actually, he's one who's not afraid to talk about taxes. So you are going to see a distinction there. I think there are differences between Steve Sisolak and Brian Sandoval, for sure. You know, I think one of the dangers for Sisolak is that Northern Nevadans, as we all know, have a great deal of antipathy for Southern Nevada politicians. If they have even a hint of scandal, it's easy to paint them with a broad brush. And, you know, Washoe County has a lot of independent Democratic voters who are more than happy to vote for Brian Sandoval. So, you know, I think Democrats definitely need the right kind of candidate in there to make it a race. And, you know, Tick Sagerbloom, I could see him coming up and being a darling of the Democrats in Washoe County and maybe, you know, easing some of that crossover voting that might go into Sandoval's column. It definitely would be a fun race because, you know, Sagerbloom's not afraid to say interesting things. But I guess my point was going to be that if we don't see an interesting gubernatorial race develop, maybe the most interesting one will be for a lieutenant governor, which is kind of a sad commentary on the state of the race in 2014. But, you know, there's a lot of speculation that Sandoval will not serve an entire second term. Whether he chooses to run against U.S. Senator Harry Reid in 2016, which looks like a diminishing possibility at this point. He hasn't really seemed to be chomping at the bit to make that race. He kind of likes being governor. Or maybe, you know, a federal appointment, depending on who's president. So I think both parties are looking at lieutenant governor as the race to really fill with candidates. And we saw the governor and the Republican Party come out in favor of Mark Hutchison, state senator, who announced last week that he's going to run for lieutenant governor. Now we get to see who's going to be on the Democratic side.
There were some murmurs that was that Lucy Flores might run. Have you heard anything more on that?
Yeah, political observers and insiders say that at this point she looks to be one of their most likely candidates. She's not said anything publicly one way or the other. Political journalist John Ralston has pointed out that she's seems to be running for re-election at this point. At least most of her campaign material and fundraising efforts are geared towards running for her assembly seat. But that could change quickly, and I think a lot of Democrats are excited to see her on a statewide ballot, particularly as a way to drive the Hispanic vote, which, you know, this year I think is going to be a challenge for Democrats to really keep that constituency engaged and active at the polls.
What, as long as we're talking about that race, what are the strengths and weaknesses of each candidate?
Well, I think, you know, Senator Hutchison is seen as a kind of an exciting up-and-comer by Republicans, and I think even Democrats alike. He had his freshman session this year and really impressed people on both sides of the aisle. I think he was a straight shooter. He seemed to be thoughtful. He worked with your favorite senator, Patrick, Senator Segerblum, on getting the medical marijuana dispensary bill through. I think if it weren't for Senator Hutchison, that bill would have gone down in flames, because Senator Segerblum really made Hutchison, who's a Republican, the champion of that bill. He got it through the Senate. He got it past the governor, I think, in many ways. So he, you know, he's seen as thoughtful, intelligent, ambitious, certainly. He's got some, I guess, potential areas for attack. He led the legal fight against the Affordable Care Act prior to being elected senator.
State's lawsuit against the federal government.
Right. And, you know, that lawsuit ultimately was not successful. And that can make him popular with the Republican base, but I think that you'll see Democrats attack him on that. Lucy Flores, again, politically speaking, she is young, she's dynamic, she's Latina, she's got a great life story that she's not afraid to talk about, coming out of a difficult childhood where, she was exposed to, you know, criminal activity and drugs and all sorts of very difficult upbringing for her, which she overcame, went to law school. And, you know, she's, I guess, some of the drawbacks on her, she's definitely untested statewide. She seems to be adored by many in the Democratic base in her district. I don't know if she's quite as popular with her colleagues. Sometimes I think her ambition and ways that she deals with people have rubbed others the wrong way. But, you know, that's certainly overcomable. She's, again, bright and enthusiastic, ambitious. So I think that would be a good race between the two of them.
And of course, you did neglect to mention Flores's biggest liability, that she's a USC grad.
Oh. I guess for Notre Dame grads, that's a problem.
Harry Reid doesn't like USC either, apparently.
He doesn't?
He said something about their football team. He disparaging remarks. Very, you know.
Yeah,
I just can't keep up with the sports talk.
Heller defended.
Dean
Heller defended it, so it became a partisan issue.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Not everything's a partisan issue.
All right. What about the rest of the 2014? The biggest issue, I think, the candidates don't even really matter as much to me as the margins tax.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting to see. The teachers and the labor unions have vowed to put significant resources towards running that campaign. I imagine that there will be an equally well-funded campaign, probably led by the chamber, to defeat it. I also don't think that it's necessarily a done deal that it will be on the ballot. There's still an opportunity for legal challenges to the content of the question itself. So that may or may not occur.
I thought that it had cleared those hurdles. That's not so?
Well, there's two opportunities to bring a legal challenge. One is prior to the ballot being, or the question being validated by the signatures. They can attack, as they tried to do, the description of effect. But once it's gotten all the signatures and once it's been approved for the ballot, other legal challenges can be brought as far as the substance of the question. We've seen that happen in the past with the Caesars Arena petition, for example. So, you know, I think there's still an opportunity for that to occur. But the other interesting development is that we need to wait and see who is going to actually come out in favor and go out there and be a champion besides labor unions and the teachers unions. You know, are there going to be any elected Democrats? Andrew actually got an interesting quote from Harry Reid. It was in effect, what's that? What's the margins tax? I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about. worry about other elected officials this week have, you know, they've been wishy-washy on whether or not they're going to support it. And it's going to be a difficult place for Democrats to be because they came out and proposed the margins tax to begin with. This is a little bit different than what they proposed in 2011, actually significantly different. It's a much larger rate. But are they going to run away from, you know, their key constituencies, people that are very important to their races, teachers and labor unions, and not back or be actively involved in trying to get this passed? It's going to be a really interesting dynamic.
My prediction is that elected Democrats will take the most craven, callow, cowardly position that is possible, and I also predict that it will not work. So, but I won't be around. Well, of course, I'll be here in a year, so I guess I'll be back, and then we can talk about this. All right. So, Anjanette, how about the rest of the? Who's going to control the? How's the candidate recruitment going? That's a huge factor.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the control of the state Senate hangs in the balance of the 2014 election. And there are, and actually, Andrew can probably speak a little bit more to this. Andrew, refresh my memory. There are three races that are really important.
Right. Basically, the state Senate right now, it's 11 seats are Democratic, 10 are Republican. So it sort of hangs in the balance this election. Who's going to take control of that? And I think everyone in the political world is really looking at three seats, three state Senate seats. One, Barbara Sagavsky, she's term limited out. She's gone. That's an open seat, a contested district. Another one is Senate Minority Leader, Republican Michael Roberson. He's in a district in Henderson, actually just across the street from where we're sitting right now. And his is viewed as potentially something Democrats could pick up. And then Justin Jones down in the southwest corner of the valley, he's a Democrat, but Republicans think they can pick that up. So
he replaced someone in 12, and now he has to turn around and run again, right?
Yeah.
Right, and he won by a very narrow margin. So, that's winnable for Republicans. Will, and I'll put this out to Anjanette and Andrew. Will Roberson get primaried? Republicans, conservatives who are upset with his maverick-y ways?
His potential. He's definitely taken some...
the mining industry?
He's definitely not the mining industry's favorite person this time. I would imagine we will see resources poured into the campaign of either a primary or a general election opponent by the mining industry, unless he does something to repair that relationship. And I don't think either side is really prepared to do that. I would say that Senator Roberson is ripe for a primary challenge. He won that seat to begin with. It was different circumstances. The strength of the Tea Party Republicans seems to be waning, at least in our elections. But he won his seat largely by being the no new taxes pledge signer, fiery conservative. And he's definitely backed away from that persona both sessions of the legislature. So I have not heard yet any potential names. Andrew, have you heard of any potential conservative challengers?
I have not. Not from Michael Roberson. I know Senator Ben Kiekheffer, another fairly moderate Republican. Now, here's a guy who voted for same-sex marriage. He might face a primary challenger. There's been some chatter about Assemblyman Jim Wheeler, who considers himself a very conservative guy, to run against him potentially, but he's not said one way or another.
Well, that could be interesting to watch. Anything else on 2014, Anjanette?
Well, I guess we haven't talked about probably the most important race in Las Vegas certainly will be for Congressional District 3, Congressman Joe Heck against Democrat Aaron Bilbray. And so that's going to be nationally a very important race as Democrats fight to try and take control of the House. It's a swing district. You know, as far as the statewide ballot is concerned, it doesn't have a lot of effect. But nationally, you're going to see tremendous resources poured into that race. You're going to see a lot of television ads. You're going to see, I would imagine, some fairly ugly fighting for that seat. I would imagine that Joe Heck has the advantage at this point. You know, he's been elected twice now. He's fairly well-liked. He's going to have to walk some difficult lines on immigration and votes that he's had to make with the rest of his Republican conference in the House. He's going to have to explain to voters there.
He's going to have to explain his wackadoodle friends.
I know national Democratic group is, I think, targeting three GOP House members with ads on immigration, and one of them was Heck. It was Heck and someone in California.
Right, the Spanish language ads have already started in the district.
And they're definitely watching closely what he's going to do on immigration, and we'll see. I mean, he's in a really diverse district. So.
And at this point, he's come out against the Senate compromise, right?
Right, that's right. And he said that he wouldn't vote yes on what came out of the Senate, but he's in favor of immigration reform, but he likes the piecemeal approach that the House is taking, which so far doesn't address nearly as many areas of the issue that the Senate did, but maybe they'll introduce more bills.
I think, that race would be, it's going to be interesting to watch, but it would be really interesting if Heck appointed his son as a spokesman, Joey Heck. That would really just amp up the race.
Well, we know he's familiar with social media. So.
Yeah, just social media director, not spokesman, just social media director. Yeah.
So who's running against Heck? Aaron Bilbray, right? What's she all about? Who is she, and what's kind of her story?
She's been a political operative for a long time. She's been involved in helping Democrats kind of on that staff and volunteer and activist level. But she's never run for office before. And it's interesting, Democrats have tried before to put up so-called Democratic operatives. I'm thinking of Tessa Hafen, for example. But, you know, people who have been involved in the party, involved in the political process, but not necessarily someone who's ever run for office before, has like, you know, a resume outside of politics that would be useful for being a candidate. So I think that is going to have to be an obstacle that she overcomes. But, you know, she's well-connected. I think that she will be a prolific fundraiser.
And her father was a congressman.
And she has the name recognition from her dad, which, you know, has been an issue in the campaign already. She doesn't like to use both of her hyphenated name. She wants to be just Aaron Bilbray on the ballot. And, you know, I think that is a nod to her father, who may have some name recognition left after years and years.
Right. I mean, it's been so long that I think so many people in Nevada now they weren't even here when he was the congressman.
That's certainly true in Las Vegas.
All right, so that's 2014. Anjanette, thanks for joining us. We're going to let you go.
Thank you so much. Good luck, Patrick.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, guys. Let's turn to some other issues here. Andrew, you have written a story about the new increase in funding in English language learner education.
The first funding ever from the state for ELO.
Right, $50 million. Before that, I guess we were one of three states, the other two being Montana and South Dakota, that didn't have any kind of state money going to
Well, we have a lot in common with them.
Learn English, right? Yeah.
Predominantly white states, tiny, some rural.
Some libertarian.
Right, maybe 50 years ago.
So new money that is hard to believe, first time from money from the state. And previously, were we getting federal money or?
We were, and we still are. We mm-hmm. still are getting federal money. Mm-hmm. The Title I funding comes in to help provide some English instruction for students who can't understand or read or write or speak English well.
Is there any federal match, like in terms of us spending, if we put in state money, are we getting more federal money because of that?
Yeah, I think that would be the case. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm sure the folks at the district are smart enough to figure out that if they can put some state money in there, they can leverage federal money for that. That's a pretty common occurrence.
And so what is the district thinking? They must be pretty elated at this infusion of money.
Yeah, you know, I think about $38 million of it comes to Clark County. It's $50 million statewide. We obviously get the lion's share of that with the highest need, highest population.
Wait, there, so we got 76% of it?
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's not nearly enough, I think. Given our population and our population of ELL students, there's no way that that's adequate compared to the rest of the state. But anyway, that's...
It only goes to 14 schools in Clark County, so... There's hundreds of schools. Mm-hmm. This touches a very small number of students in the end, 14 schools.
Mm-hmm. So 14 schools, $38 million. How is the money spent?
It's spent a number of ways. You have pre-kindergarten, full-day kindergarten, class. They're going to keep class sizes smaller. They'll establish reading centers, I think, in a partnership with UNLV. Have some tutors come in, help these kids learn to read in English. And they're even talking about doing year-round school, having some kind of summer academy so that children don't go home into something like a predominantly Spanish-speaking environment and forget a lot of the English that they learned.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a number of things that money buys.
Mm-hmm.
You've been asking sort of people now that it's a done deal. You've been, I know, getting a reaction from people. What are you hearing just from the people you talked to about the issue?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is this passed the legislature unanimously. The governor wholeheartedly, you know, happily signed it and sent out press releases about it. The Clark County School Board unanimously accepted the money. It seems like everyone in the political and education world and sort of the establishment thinks this is great. But when it's talked about in the community, when we've written stories about it, you see some comments and people think that a special group, you know, sometimes they're called illegal immigrants or labeled as foreigners or invaders, that these other people are getting some kind of special treatment.
And but I mean, just to clarify, we're talking about children.
Right, right. These are children here, most of them in elementary school, who, for whatever reason, aren't really proficient in the English language, and can't function in a classroom well because they can't understand the teacher, can't read their homework, and it basically can't learn because they don't understand the language in which they're being taught.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be pointed out, obviously, not every one of these students is ELL, but our schools are sort of reflecting our changing demographics and that they're ahead of, say, the state averages. And I think either 50 or 60% of the students in Clark County below sixth grade are Hispanic. Now, not all of those are ELL students, but it just shows that, I mean, there's been a rapid influx and I mean, you have to address the students that you have in your schools. Right?
Presumably. All right. So let's shift gears. Andrew, you also have a story today about the energy monopoly will be giving us all rebates.
Maybe. So what happened last year, Indy Energy posted record profits. And since they're the only energy provider really in the state, they're a regulated monopoly. The state gets to say how much they can make. They have what's called an authorized rate of return. So they exceeded that. They actually, I know this sounds weird for a private investor-owned company, but they actually made too much money. And the Bureau of Consumer Protection in the Attorney General's office said, hey, wait a sec. You, the utility, are charging us, the customers, for the energy we don't use. And that's because they have an energy efficiency charge. So say, Patrick, you get some new windows because you want to have a more energy efficient home. The utility will say, hey, wait, we aren't collecting as much from Patrick because he's not using as much energy. But the utility will say, well, we have the same infrastructure that we still need to upkeep, so we're going to charge you anyway. Mm-hmm. It's called lost sales compensation. The Bureau of Consumer Protection said, wait a sec. Last year, the utility made record profits, exceeded their authorized rate of return. That's where I said they made too much money. So he's based the guy, Dan Jacobson at the Bureau of Consumer Protection, is basically saying what lost sales. Mm-hmm. So we might get total 14.6 million coming back. I think it really boils down to like $7 maybe.
Right.
For the average residential customer. Not right. much, but maybe symbolic.
Do we know why their profits were so high? They're obviously effective managers over there. But their profits definitely increased. I mean, this is related to the rate increases, right?
Part of it's rate increases. That's a process that Southern Nevada went through last year, the rate making process. They posted a $322 million annual profit from 2012. The company said in that news release that basically they couldn't help but make a lot of money because it was hot in the summer down here.
That's what
people cranked up their ACs,
right.
used a lot of energy, and the profit was just sort of
a
result of that.
So this year they're really making money, huh? Because it's been really hot.
I'm sure they will. Yeah, 2 years ago, I recall, it was during the legislature. There was a very cooler spring and early summer in Las Vegas, and this was thought to be an explanation for their extremely aggressive legislative agenda. Because it's like, you know, the amount of lobbying they do is proportional to or inversely proportional to how hot it is. It's a strange business model. So we may or may not get some money back.
Right.
I mean, this is going to go before the PUC and they'll have to make a decision.
Yeah. So the Bureau of Consumer Protection says, let's get this refund. The Public Utilities Commission staff says, yeah, we agree. Customers, you guys should get the refund. The utility is going to come back at the end of this month, at the end of July, and say maybe not. They have an opportunity to issue a rebuttal. But I talked to the spokespeople over there. They wouldn't even say whether they plan to go along with it or oppose it. They just flatly denied to comment. So we'll see what happens in August. That's when the commission they'll make a ruling and say yes, customers get a refund, or no, NV Energy gets to keep that money.
So and the PUC gets the final word on it?
Yeah, there's three members of the commission, so majority will make that decision.
All of this shows, as I think, Andrew, you're well aware, the importance of that consumer advocate who works for the attorney general. So whoever the attorney general is has a big say in how aggressive we are in protecting or attempting to protect consumers. And then, of course, the PUC appointed by the governor. So that's – in some ways, it's one of the most important reasons those – one of the most important things about those elected
right.
offices.
They're literally – the Bureau of Consumer Protection, those guys are literally the only ones in the room who
right.
represent just regular people.
Right.
Everyone else is usually at a PUC meeting. They come from some – they have some industry background, or they're the utilities representatives. They may have similar interests to consumers, but they oftentimes don't. So it is – that's true. I think the Bureau of Consumer Protection, you know, depending on the AG, can really be a watchdog for consumers or a lapdog for the industry depending on who's there.
All right. Keep that in mind. We're going to wrap it up. Our producer is Steven Zeller. We want to thank him as always. This is Patrick Hooligan, my co-host as always, Tovin LePan, and welcome our new host, Andrew Doman. I'm signing off for the last time here on Neon Eden. You've been listening to KUNV 91.5.